Hi, folks. Next up on This Week in Law, we'll have me, I'm Denise Howell, Evan Brown, Declan McCullough, and Sherwin C. We're going to look at some upcoming pending legislation, whether FISA can be improved or not, USA Freedom, will it really give us further transparency? Sherwin gets a new boss, and his old boss goes to the FCC. We'll look at some interesting issues around stock photography and Stream Nation's new business model, all that and a lot more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 235, recorded November 8, 2013. Model clientele. Hi, folks. You're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and we have a stupendous panel for you today. I'm so excited, so let's just get right into it, introduce them, and jump into the discussion. Joining us now from CNET and his current project, Recent, is Declan McCullough. Hello, Declan.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's wonderful to have you. As I was telling you just before we started the show, you have been on our coveted want-to-have-on-the-show guest list for quite some time. So really, really excited that we were able to work it out with your schedule and that you could join us today.
Yeah, I'm glad the timing worked. I'm taking a sabbatical from CNET to work on a side project. But we can, I can mention that later. I don't mean to interrupt the flow.
Not at all. We do want to hear all about it. Also joining us, though, from Public Knowledge is Sherwin C. Hello, Sherwin.
Hello. Good to be on. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you back. Lots of fun stuff going on in your neck of the woods and interesting developments regarding Public Knowledge, including someone else who had been long on our want to have on the show guest list for a while, Gigi Sohn, who was on with us a few weeks ago, is going to be moving on from your organization, we understand.
Yeah, that's right. She's going to be working for the FCC. She's going to be working in the chairman's office, actually. So that's exciting stuff.
It is exciting stuff. And we want to get your take on that, too, in a few minutes. But I also want to introduce our final member of our cast today, Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, and the Info Law Group firm. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Hope your Friday's going well. This ought to be an awesome conversation. Sherwin, great to see you again. And, you know, Declan, wanted to talk to you for years. So this is going to be great. Really should be awesome.
Yes. Declan, I think we might have actually met in person at one point or another, either the Tech Policy Summit or some tech policy confab one place or another. But you're usually so busy moderating and being brilliant that it's tough to grab a few minutes of your time. So we really are thrilled to have more than a few minutes today.
Oh, you're very kind. I mean, I've had some fun moderating these events over the years, but it's really the moderator's job is just to be entertaining. I mean, the panelists have all the substance, so my job is an easy one.
Well, it's hard to be entertaining as a moderator. I know, having done it a few times, that it can definitely be a challenge. So, yes, you pull it off with aplomb, inevitably. And in fact, we're going to talk about one of the interviews that you did recently in just a bit. But I'd like to start, if we could, on the copyright front. So, Sherwin, you've been noticing a bunch of interesting copyright or non-copyright stories, as the case may be, sort of masquerading as copyright stories in the last week or so. So I thought we'd take a look at them. The common theme here kind of being that copyright law has become so broad and ubiquitous, and people sort of think of it first when something else may actually be the legal basis for their claim, or there may be no legal basis at all, but copyright may sort of be filling in the gap that exists in the law. Let's look at the Apple tracker issue first. This was a site that received a takedown notice from Apple that challenged them for basically a terms of service violation. The developer got a message, a letter, presumably an email in today's day and age, from an attorney from Apple saying that the site was scraping the Apple's page in an unauthorized way. The site itself existed to help users locate Apple stores with iPhones and iPads available for sale. So it was leveraging information from the Apple site. Apple, like many sites, has a term in their terms of service that says you may not scrape our page or use automatic processes to access and copy portions of the site. There's been litigation on this kind of front for many, many years. And trespass to chattels is often an interesting theory that comes up when this is going on. But this has not proceeded to litigation. What happened here was Apple fired off a letter. The developer received it and presumed it was a DMCA takedown notice. Is that right, Sherwin?
Yeah, I think so. What happened is I'm not sure if they sent the letter to the developer or if it went to the company that was hosting the web page. But it was framed. Actually, if you look at the letter itself, and I think the article that's linked in the rundown has a copy of that, it's formulated like a DMCA takedown notice. It follows the same sort of steps. And when the developer posted it up on his website, he included the title, you know, DMCA notice. So that was sort of the general assumption, which is a really strange thing to do. Well, I mean, it's not a strange thing to make that assumption, because I think that's the sort of notice people are used to getting in these sorts of cases. And the funny thing about that is it would have been a flawed DMCA notice. It would have been an invalid DMCA notice because it didn't specify what copyrights were being infringed. Actually, and this is a question I'd still want to ask is, you know, so what is this letter? I mean, what is its significance? It's just, as far as I can tell, it's just sort of a nasty letter from a lawyer threatening possibly potential legal action. I don't think the host has any obligation to act on it if they don't think they're in the wrong.
Right. And therein lies the rub. You know, you draft it like a DMCA takedown notice, and if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, people are going to maybe treat it like a duck and take down whatever it is that was complained of, thinking that that's the process that's in play here. But that might not necessarily be the case.
Right. I mean, so, you know, if it were, alleged to be a copyright infringement, then, you know, sure, you'd see if it complies with the DMCA, and then the host might have an obligation to take it down. And there's obviously you can't copyright just facts, like how many iPhones did this store have in stock and so on and so forth. And violating somebody's terms of service isn't going to be a copyright violation, unless, on the face of it, just doing something that's against whatever is on the terms of service isn't going to be that. And frankly, I'm not entirely sure, what violating the terms of service shouldn't, create an obligation. Somebody whose information is hosted on a host thing, the host doesn't have an obligation to police that for anything, but certainly not for a violation of terms of service. And then we wouldn't be looking at the DMCA. We'd be looking at CDA 230 safe harbors.
Right. Evan, so you remember the Ticketmaster versus Tickets.com case, right?
Sure, that's a classic.
An oldie but a goodie.
Right.
I can't remember if it's so old that it predated the DMCA.
I don't think so. The DMCA was in October of 98, and I think the Ticketmaster case was like in 99 or 2000, right? And Ticketmaster has been an active litigant in all of this as well. So, yeah, I see where you're going with this discussion on this.
Right. So in that case, an important issue was whether what was being scraped was copyrightable or was pure facts, as Sherwin was alluding to. Do you think it's possible, Evan, to draft a DMCA takedown notice in this kind of situation that could specify what exactly was being infringed and could actually identify something that was copyrightable.
Well, I think in our discussion here, we're outlining the contours of what the issues are. I mean, I tack on to things that Sherwin was saying, identifying the problematic issues with all of this, and you could hear the reticence in Sherwin's voice, or you could tell that there was a lot of thought going on talking about whether or not it should be a copyright violation that would warrant a DMCA takedown notice for merely violating a site's terms of service. And I think in general that's true. But what we've got to further evaluate and look at is whether or not that violation of the site's terms of service results in the use of copyrighted material, you know, using the material that resides on that site, exercising one of the exclusive rights of the copyright holder under Section 106, for example, making a copy, displaying a different copy of that outside of the scope of the authorization that is granted in those terms of service. So it is conceivable in the abstract, and we don't have to stay abstract for too long. We can think of real concrete examples of where violation of the site's terms of service result in a use of the copyrighted work beyond the scope that's permitted in those terms of service, and thereby creating an infringement, which clearly then gives us a clear pathway into the territory, the realm of Section 512 of the Copyright Act, the DMCA take notice and takedown provision here. So then there is that issue, and I think this is what you were actually asking about, right, Denise? You know, whether or not that content is copyrightable. Things like images, clearly those things are copyrightable. Mere facts, we're getting much more down to the idea expression dichotomy level there, much more of a metaphysical, theoretical question. But, you know, for a lot of content, it would be clearly copyrightable, and I don't see a problem with this at all. The real troublesome part is just the appearance of overextension on Apple's part doing this, acting too far.
Well,
yes.
A couple of things on that is, you know, one of them that I would think is facts aren't copyrightable. Just the, you know, those straight up numbers as to which stores have which, you know, what inventory, that's not going to be copyrightable.
Right.
And then the other thing that bothers me is, let's say, I mean, if you take it that you can sort of leverage a violation of terms of service into a copyright violation, that opens the door to all sorts of weird issues. So let's say, you know, you can take something that's, you know, fairly straightforward. Okay, somebody posts a bunch of photographs they've taken up on their website. And they post that up and say, hey, these are licensed in a certain way. Please don't share these unless you do X, Y, and Z. Maybe it's Creative Commons. You know, don't do it unless it's for a non-commercial purpose and so on. Fine. Somebody goes and does that. Well, they're already infringing copyright. You don't need to worry about the terms of service. Now, the case that Evan's talking about is, well, let's say, you know, you're doing something with it that that wouldn't be a copyright violation. But let's say you stick a notice on there, maybe a license agreement, a terms of service that says, you're free to share this stuff only if you agree to, give me $1 million. You know, and so, you know, the idea there is not giving them that $1 million means, okay, now you violated their copyright because you haven't abided by the terms of the license. Now, what would be on the Apple website that's both copyrightable and that is being copied in some way or publicly performed or publicly displayed? Let's assume that there's something that is copyrightable that they're using. Well, what's the copy that's being made? Is it really just the reproduction on somebody's computer? Well, that happens every time you look at a website. So now, am I just going to put a bunch of images up on my website and say, by reproducing these in your computer's RAM, you're agreeing to the terms of the these terms of service? And now you have to do all sorts of things. You have to donate, you know, $200 to Public Knowledge. If you don't do that, you're violating the copyright. Yeah. So, and we'll get a nice $750 from you.
Right. There are exceptions though for search engines and for local copies, etc., that cover that kind of use, as long as you're not republishing and redisplaying, as you said, Sherwin.
Well,
isn't that right?
Statutorily, no. I think, you know, in order to in order to for those things not to be infringements, just the reproduction, you're basically relying upon either a fair use argument, which is, you know, that's a very broad interpretation of fair use, one that I think should apply, but it's not so certain. You could also say maybe it's de minimis, or you could say that it's sort of an implied license, that by putting something up on a website, you're understanding that people are going to look at it and that RAM copies are going to be made of it.
All right. Declan, is this causing you any trepidation to know that DMCA takedown notices might be being misused?
Well, I mean, the way I think of it is this. If you went physically, I mean, the problem is, Apple stores have mixed inventories. This one might have the new iPhone 5 or 6 or S in stock. This one may not. So how do you find the answer? I mean, you could either go into each store, send your minions into each store. That's legal. Let's say that this information were published in the newspaper. You could read that and then type it into your database or OCR it. That would be legal. But the most obvious and easy way of doing it, which is going on Apple's website, is illegal, arguably, because of the reach of either copyright law or the terms of use, terms of service. And so I'm not sure if this is something that makes a lot of sense if we were designing the system from scratch, but this is the way it is. It's odd that we have this very turbocharged takedown and removal process only for copyright. And this is the DMCA process we all know and more or less love, right? I mean, how about privacy? How about libel? I mean, why does copyright get this special treatment? I mean, I think we know the answer to that. It's special interest lobbies. It's a gradual expansion of copyright law over many, many decades. And you have very few people pushing back, and public knowledge is one of them, to its credit.
Yes. And I think you raise a really good point, Declan, that the cases that have come out in favor of companies who have, you know, planted their flag on their terms of service and said, thou shalt not scrape, and have done so under this really creaky doctrine of law called trespass to chattels, which relies on the theory that you're doing some kind of damage through your activity. You're making it difficult for the servers to perform their intended and business necessary functions through these additional burdens that you're placing on it. I think that in today's day and age of, you know, greater processor power, larger drives, et cetera, you know, Moore's Law, I'm wondering whether it has completely invalidated the trespass to chattels doctrine, and whether if that were used today, courts would have to rethink things based on the way technology has progressed.
Well, I mean, you can imagine some cases where you have a rather small website that's not using something like a Google App Engine or AWS or Akamai, and it can be overloaded by a scraper that's poorly programmed. And instead of waiting maybe 10 seconds between requests, it's waiting 10 milliseconds between requests. I mean, the website could be brought to its knees through a bunch of these. It amounts to a non-distributed denial of service attack. And so in cases like that, you might want to have some sort of legal recourse. But where's the harm if you just make a connection to apple.com and the cost to Apple is basically negligible?
Yep, I agree. Evan, any final thoughts on this?
Well, I think the courts have sort of made their decisions in conformity with the sensibility that we're talking about here. I'm thinking of the Intel versus Hamidi case out there in California from maybe 10 years or so ago, requiring there to actually be a diminution of the system. And that's kind of baked into the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, too, the notion of damages under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, actually data being destroyed or the performance of the system there. So it's not like, you know, the reality is totally cockamamie and, you know, in some strange form. I think that there is some real common sense in the way that courts have come down on these things.
All right. A couple of other interesting copyright cases that Sherwin noticed over the last week or so. One in a post by Professor Goldman on his technology and marketing law blog, which has a nice redesign. I'm not sure when he instituted that, but it's looking good over there. And just to point out that there is this case called Banex Corp versus Costco Wholesale Corp was decided middle of last month that took 70 pages and 4.5 years of litigation and counting to determine that a number, 3.95%, was not copyrightable. Now, it's a little bit more nuanced than that because of the notion that numbers, prices are not copyrightable, but in certain instances, estimates, compilations can be copyrightable. So the court had to go through a huge number of hoops in reaching its determination that if you're using a number like 3.95%, you can do that without having to separately license it from the person who did the original compilation. So it's just another example, I think, Sherwin, of where our copyright law is giving people business models that might not otherwise exist.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that Eric points out in his blog post, and I agree with him on, is it really shouldn't take 70 pages to make this decision. You know, the question of what is and isn't copyrighted is pretty simple. It's, okay, what they're suing over is this number. What they went through to get that number is kind of irrelevant as to it's actually totally relevant as to whether or not it's copyrightable. The thing that we're concerned about is that result. People went through, you know, years and decades of effort to derive scientific formulas to, you know, to come up with particular numbers, to find out what the gravitational constant is, right? It took a lot of time and effort to do that. It's a number. That's a fact. We don't try and recompense them for all of that effort because we don't want facts to be copyrightable.
All right. And not to spend too much time on these sort of strange instances of copyright, but there is one more that really is a great law school exam kind of question. And that is these folks in East New York who have literally cornered a piece of wall where a Banksy stencil was put up. And are charging people who come by and want to, you know, they've heard that the Banksy piece is there. They're charging people $20 to take a look. And they're being very proprietary, not just about access, but about taking pictures. They don't own the wall. They're not, you know, authorized by Banksy to be the gatekeepers of this copy of his work. So it's a very interesting little nugget that you've hit on here, Sherwin, and you wrote it up over at Public Knowledge.
Yeah, so there's I wrote a little post about it on the blog. I think mostly because what sort of inspired me to write something about it is people started going, well, what's Banksy's rights in this? They don't have any rights to Banksy's work. And it's like, well, okay, that's true, but you know, there's no copyright question here because Banksy's the one who, you know, ostensibly would own the copyright. That's fine, but what you do with a copy of a copyrighted work, that sort of physical thing that's out in the world, it's already on display. Nobody's making copies of it or anything like that. So actually, Banksy has no sort of legal recourse or no legal inroad to this whole situation. And so the question is, well, who owns that particular copy? Because they would have control of how they would be able to do that. And I think the answer to that is whoever owns that wall. So I don't actually know what the legality is of people doing this. And then there was this whole really interesting sort of social question of, well, Banksy came here and decided he was going to use this wall in our neighborhood as part of his canvas. So aren't these guys taking that back? And then there's a question of, well, but who are these guys to speak for the neighborhood? There's a whole lot of other people who live there. So I think the questions have less to do with copyright, though they do have a lot to do with the way people really inherently think about ownership of culture. And there's a nice little back and forth there that I thought was worth exploring.
Yeah, and it's worth noting too that wall is not blank. It's full of other copyrightable works, arguably, various other graffiti, which, you know, if you go and look up the ordinances in the city of New York, I'm sure aren't supposed to be there in the first place. Declan, do you have any thoughts about this?
Well, the way I think of it is kind of this wonderful example of art appearing, valuable art appearing overnight. I mean, you go to sleep and you have a townhouse or apartment building in a certain part of New York City, and then you wake up, and all of a sudden, this artwork that might, in theory, be worth thousands of dollars appears. I mean, there's an artist, J.S.G. Boggs, who creates hand-drawn copies or versions of dollar bills and British pounds, and they don't look exactly like. I mean, they're drawn by hand, and so he'll sell them to you for $100 at face value of the note, even though it's worth maybe tens of thousands of dollars. And so, if you're lucky enough to own a restaurant where he comes in and sells you this for a meal, you're doing quite well. His dollar bills are in the Smithsonian and the MoMA in New York, and so on. And so it's just. I mean, I don't know if the copyright and property rights reasons are that great. I mean, if it's my wall, it's my wall, and I can either destroy it or I can restrict access if I can, if it's not in a public street. So it's kind of interesting, but the social impacts are more interesting than the legal ones, I think.
Evan, any thoughts?
Well, yeah, and I mean, as far as looking at the legal impact and the legal questions here, the ones I'm more interested in are actually have to deal with trespass in a public place and the enforceability of any contract that these guys who are, you know, don't own that property and presumably don't own that space on the sidewalk, you know, what right do they have to exclude others to be there to look at this piece of Banksy artwork? And so, you know, do they have an enforceable contract with the people who decide to come up and actually pay them $20 or whatever to look at the artwork? You could argue that the subject matter of that contract is unlawful if the subject matter is either you pay me or I will physically exclude you from this place of public property, then, you know, that wouldn't be an enforceable contract. But if the contract is, you know, you pay me $20 for the privilege of standing here with me and admiring this piece of Banksy artwork, that might be an enforceable contract. So in any event, you know, the copyright issues are interesting, and it raises these questions of ownership of copyright versus ownership of the physical medium. But I think it's kind of wacky to think about these other issues about the rights to actually be somewhere in a public space and the right to exclude others from that. And what right do these jokers have to be charging people money to come and see this artwork?
Yeah, it seems to me that if someone were to, that they're probably violating the law in some way or another by blocking off the sidewalk and the street and.
Yeah, I mean every local community has, you know, like loitering statutes and public trespass in their municipal ordinance. So I'm sure the cops could say, "Move along here, nothing to see."
Right. Yeah, that's actually so. Something I was wondering about is, you know, what if they're not trying to, you know, exclude people from a particular physical space? What they're excluding is, you know, what they're doing is obscuring a sight line. And so now I'm trying to think about, oh, what about all these cases where, a luxury hotel goes up next to another one and blocks out the view? Is that analogous? And it just goes in all sorts of weird directions.
Right. Packeteer is reminding us that people have actually chopped out Banksy works from their walls and sold them for $1 million or more. So
people tried to do that with this one too, actually. Yeah, I think both before these guys arrived and then shortly after, I think somebody actually chopped it out of the wall, and I don't know who it was. But there was this sort of theory that, oh, by monetizing this, by sort of charging admission to see this street art, are these guys, you know, incentivized to protect it? Well, it didn't really work out.
Right. All right, well, let's move on to some stories on the privacy front. Declan, one of the ways that you've surfaced and kept your hand in at CNET recently was to do a great interview with Ladar Levison of LavaBit. Leah Laporte chatted with him not too long ago on a show on our network too called Triangulation. So Ladar is definitely out there and letting people know what happened to him and litigating this issue of his having been held in contempt of court. It looks like now he and the Silent Circle folks are working proactively to solve the problem of insecure email with the Dark Mail Alliance. Did you guys talk about that?
We did. This was a discussion, even though I'm on sabbatical, I hosted it last week at CNET's headquarters in San Francisco. And so we brought him in and had a, I think it was about a 2-hour discussion, including a Q&A session. It went pretty well. It was the first time he went through the step-by-step exactly what happened, the details of his interactions with the feds over a multi-month period. It actually started before Edward Snowden's name became public in June. But to respond to your point about the plans to fix email, I mean, I think a lot of technologists nowadays think or have concluded that email is broken. The question is how to fix it. I mean, do you want to? It should be an open protocol. It should be something that a lot of people can get involved in. But is it going to rely on more centralized servers, or is everyone going to run their own mail server on their network? I mean, this is what we already are running our own networks at home and at work. They're called routers, and so maybe we just stick mail servers there, and they're more secure. My only concern is that the cryptographers participate as well, and this become a more open, standardized process. Because when you have a bunch of engineers who are focused on building on building code, trying to do crypto, mistakes can happen. And this is one of the problems that we saw with Lavabit itself. Moxie Marlinspike wrote an essay in the last week that he pointed out the problems, the cryptographic problems that Lavabit had. I mean, there should be in his argument no way that Lidar could have complied with the order if Lavabit had been properly constructed from the beginning. So it's promising. It needs to happen. I don't know whether the best venue is these companies or the IETF. I don't know, but it's something in need of fixing.
All right. Sherwin, is public knowledge following this at all?
Not directly. I think the point that Declan makes that there's ways to engineer. Hopefully, there's ways to engineer this technically, but there can always be a weak point. And the thing that Moxie Marlinspike was pointing out is, under enough, if you, the provider, are making promises based upon making promises about the security of the system based upon what your users are willing to trust you on, then you're still a weak point to, I think what people call rubber hose decryption, which is, either through force or force of law, you're forced to turn over that stuff. There's some things that can't be engineered around, and the only way to do that is to make sure that those vulnerabilities aren't there in the first place.
Evan, on the legal front, as they attempt to come up with a standard that would prevent the kind of subpoena that Lavabit received from even being complied with, Lidar Levison has been held in contempt of court and is challenging that now at the appellate level. EFF is helping him out. What's your take on that situation?
I mean, at the fundamental level, you've got to really empathize with business owners who find themselves in these situations. It's really frightening. It does nothing to encourage innovation in this type of situation where you have the government coming and strong-arming business owners to turn over encryption keys like this, and it's really unsettling and really difficult. What I see as a problem here, the biggest problem is kind of the collateral damage, or at least the potential for collateral damage that you see compromising the security of everyone's communications who use the services. It's a little bit analogous to broad efforts to take down entire services like Mega Upload. I think the comparison is pretty easy to make there. You've got all these other people, legitimate users, who would never expect that the government would come and take their stuff, or at least wouldn't have reason to expect that they would, doing perfectly lawful things, just concerned about doing their own thing, not wanting to break the law or whatever. But you have the power of the government to come in and undo all this. That is something that's just incredibly frightening, and I don't think that the power of the government to do that outside of the digital world has ever existed, at least in modern Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. The comparison we see a lot in this is the government coming in and requiring a hotel to give its master key, to turn over its master key so that it can go in and search with impunity the rooms mm-hmm. of all of the guests there. And that's a terrible, very blatant violation of at least the sensibilities of the hotel guests. So, there's got to be something done not necessarily at the technological level, because no matter how sophisticated the technology gets, if there's this continuing threat, I'm talking about the encryption technology and decryption technology, there's going to be this as long as there's a continuing threat of the government coming in and strong-arming and leveraging, giving leverage over business owners on a very existential level, saying do this or, you know, you're going to be out of business, in jail, what have you. We're not secure in our persons and papers and effects in this country.
Right. And that's precisely the argument I think that EFF is putting out. Jennifer Lynch, writing on their Deep Links blog, argues that obtaining a warrant for a service's private key is no different than obtaining a warrant to search all the houses in the city to find the papers of one suspect. So we will keep an eye on this and see how EFF and Mr. Levison fare in trying to challenge this contempt order that he has been served with. Let's move on to more on the surveillance front. We're not making any friends in Germany, are we, Declan?
That's probably an understatement. I mean, it's at some level we know intellectually that the National Security Agency and other elements of our eavesdropping apparatus spy on our friends and enemies. But it's another thing to realize the details of this that have become public through Edward Snowden's revelations. I think oddly, more than a lot of the domestic outcry, it's actually the foreign policy fallout that I think might lead to some changes in D.C. It's one thing when you just have a bunch of Americans saying, my God, why are you wiretapping all of us? And why are you vacuuming up all of our phone records through the Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which the Electronic Privacy Information Center is litigating against? Mark Rotenberg was actually out here at Stanford 2 days ago to talk about it. The domestic pressure hasn't really been enough to force changes, but I think it's the foreign policy pressure and the reaction from some of our allies we're spying on that might actually fix things in D.C.
Evan, we definitely have various foreign heads of state ticked off at us. Do you think that internationally things are going to escalate around this or die out?
Gosh, who knows? I mean, you got to ask somebody who's a lot more tapped into the international policy issues than me looking at this. I mean, it's easy for us to look at it here and kind of be, to really work up some indignation is the word that's coming to me. But it's at the same time when it's talking about us and what we have done, it's embarrassment to see that this is being done. So, you know, the Angela Merkel, I think, has every reason to be very upset with this. And, you know, there's got to be, I don't know. I mean, I just throw up my hands when it comes to this one. It's going to escalate before there's any kind of, you know, real fundamental sorting it all out. And there definitely should be some transition here. You know, early on in all this, it was the people were quickly pointing out the irony, like, well, isn't it weird that it's Germany, the one that's, you know, involved with this? You know, look how times have changed since the World War II era, when it's, you know, the world is outraged because we're doing mean things to the leader of Germany. So,
right.
Gosh, I don't know.
Anne Applebaum at the Washington Post has a theory on that. She says there's an element of post-Gestapo, post-Stasi historical memory at work in Berlin, as well as joy in the revival of anti-American rhetoric that hasn't been heard in this city in years. So probably a lot of wanting to make sure that what Germany is notorious for doesn't come back at it from other countries as well. Sherwin, do you have any thoughts on this?
You know, I think that the idea that it's sort of a historical reaction coming out of Germany makes a lot of sense. I mean, they have like a Stasi museum where, you know, they have on display all of these files that I think during the Cold War, you know, these German secret police would collect on people. So there's very much sort of a sensitization to how systems of records can be abused, and, you know, and a recognition that it's very easy for something that starts with a potentially or arguably benign use gets abused.
Right. Well, moving on to one of our pet subjects as it comes up over and over again, can you be compelled to turn over passwords to encrypted material on a device? The EFF is making an argument on that front right now, has filed an amicus brief in before the High Court of Massachusetts, it looks like, along with the ACLU. There again, we have someone who's accused of being engaged in criminal activity, this time forgery. The government seized the defendant's devices with a search warrant, but couldn't break the encryption. So now they want the password or whatever key is necessary to break the encryption. And that is the issue being litigated here. What was the case involving the Colorado grandmother that we discussed a while back, Evan?
Fricasseux.
Fricasseux, that was it. So more in that vein, we're not sure what will happen here in Massachusetts, but it's worth noting that this is far from a settled issue in the U.S. at this point.
Well, it also goes, if I could interject, it also goes back to some of the Lovabit controversy. I mean, I wrote the first article that reported about the government demanding SSL keys from providers. This was back in July before Lovabit went public with their troubles in August. And I mean, if you're a provider, you don't have the Fifth Amendment defense. You're not the subject of a criminal prosecution.
Right.
But you do if you're an individual. The last I checked, the appellate courts have not ruled convincingly on this. I don't think there have been any appellate decisions. There's the Colorado case, the Fricasseux case, and there's the Boucher case in Vermont. And there's one in Florida, but I mean. Maybe one of you knows better, but I don't think we have a whole lot of guidance from the courts on this.
We don't, and I think that's why it's important to keep an eye on what the courts do with it, because there are good arguments on both sides, and it's unsettled. I think, Declan, you raise a very good point that someone's Fifth Amendment rights can be wrenched away from them if their provider gets intimidated and caves.
Which is why it's very important to either, I mean, ideally, you either, your provider cannot be forced to decrypt the information. I mean, this was the original version of Hushmail did this. I mean, this was back in the late 90s, folks. I mean, we've gotten beyond Java in the browser. We can do much more. They were compromised, but it was a modified version, not the original version that was compromised. Or maybe you run your own mail server. I know a lot of privacy protective geeks that just have it sitting on their server at home. And so then if it's raided physically, well, at least they know that the FBI was there because their front door is bashed in, as opposed to a secret search warrant or NSL or ECPA D order or other sorts of legal process sort of surreptitiously on a provider with data centers all over the world.
And your points there really underscores how this is an area in which the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment really weave in and out from one another here, the issues here, because, you know, if it's there's this fundamental question of having gotten access to the hardware on which the information is stored in the first place, and then there's a separate Fourth Amendment issue of actually doing the search on it. And so the Fifth Amendment issue I've always seen is this kind of thing that just hangs out there only on these particular issues of an order of decryption. So I think it's easy in our thinking for us to, you know, be you know, switching back and forth on the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment analysis and all this.
So the folks who generally have to parse how we implement the Fourth and Fifth Amendment in the age of technology are the legislators in Washington, D.C., in the case of the United States anyway. So there's been a lot going on the legislation and policy front. Let's take a look at some of it. A hat tip to Franklin Graves, who's joining us in IRC today for our bumpers. That's one of our favorites. Let's go on with what's going on surrounding all of the surveillance or anti-surveillance legislation. There's a lot of discussion in Washington about whether the Patriot Act and Section 215 needs to be reformed or refunded. Just recently, the senators backed an NSA bill to renew and extend this funding that needs to be in place in order for the Patriot Act to keep functioning. Is that somewhat hypocritical, Declan, when also there's a ton of discussion about we need to have more transparency and reforming legislation?
Well, I don't really trust some of the senators working on the so-called reform legislation. I mean, one of them is Senator Patrick Leahy, who was the primary author of CALEA, the 1994 wiretapping law that's actually caused some of the problems, surveillance-related problems, we're finding ourselves in now by establishing the principle that all future technology should be easily surveilled by the government. We also, he introduced a version of what would become the Patriot Act a year before the September 2001 attacks. He was the author of the Protect IP Act and so on. I mean, he's done good things as well, but this is not the hero the hero of privacy that some groups might try to paint him to be. There, I'd rather see someone like Rand Paul take the lead, or Ron Wyden on the Democratic side on some of the legislation. One other thing on Patrick Leahy, I wrote a piece in for CNET in June or July, saying that the legislation that he introduced to try to fix national security letters would actually make it more difficult for companies to challenge national security letters. So what I'm trying to get at, and this is a long way to do it, is the details matter. I mean, just because legislation is touted as we're going to fix the NSA, we're going to fix domestic surveillance, if you look at the fine print, it tends not to do that. I trust the courts a lot more than I trust Congress on this.
Sure, when public knowledge is a signatory to a letter that is urging some transparency reform, can you fill us in on both your own take and your organization's take?
Well, sure. I mean, I think right now there's basically three different bills that people are talking about. There's one that's coming out of the Intelligence Committee, one coming out of the Leahy bill coming out of Judiciary, and then there's another one that's more specifically on transparency. So just to get that one out of the way, the transparency bill is really just, it's really focusing on the sort of people who are getting requests for user information. And it's just giving them, it's very, I would think, a very modest ask, saying, hey, if an ISP gets, you know, a certain number of requests, they can report sort of within a range each year how many requests they've been getting from the government so that people know, you know, how many times records are being requested from the company. So something, you know, fairly discreet and I would think, you know, a very reasonable thing, despite whatever, you know, lawmakers might feel on any side of the debate to get through. I think I'm probably a little less skeptical than Declan on the Leahy bill. I think, you know, no bill is going to be perfect, but this one at least is saying that we don't want bulk spying to continue, which is a lot more than I can say for the bill coming out of the Intel Committee, which basically says, oh, no, the programs that we've been doing, those are fine. And in fact, we'll clarify the law to make sure that we can continue doing those.
And that's the Feinstein bill?
That's right.
And it's called, let's see, the FISA Improvements Act. Who wouldn't want to improve FISA? But apparently it's not such an improvement.
No, I think everybody's going to, given that there's a controversy, want to say, oh, yeah, there's some things that we need to improve, and then be somewhat vague as to the improvements they're actually suggesting. So it is important to pay attention to that language. I think one of the reasons that the Leahy bill can be an improvement is it does at least sort of make sure that the way that the NSA has been interpreting the existing law is not going to work.
All right. Declan, what do you think of this Feinstein bill?
Well, I would agree with the public knowledge that it's deeply flawed, or if not worse. Feinstein is my senator out here in California, and she's not really well loved in Silicon Valley. Apparently, all she gets the votes from Southern California, not Northern. But because I'm not in Washington, I can maybe be a bit more. I don't have to worry about whether a senator is going to return my phone calls or not. And I don't think that. I mean, the Leahy bill may be better, but this is. But you want something to be not just better. I mean, it's like getting. I'm going to get shot in the heart versus shot in the knee. Well, I guess I'll take getting shot in the knee. I'd rather have something to be objectively very good, because this is a once in a generation opportunity caused by Edward Snowden to really fix some of the things that the NSA has been doing. What I'm actually more concerned about than Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which gave us the Verizon phone metadata, or the so-called PRISM program, which arose out of 702, I'm actually more concerned about the bulk fiber surveillance, because that can be much more abused. I mean, if Google or Yahoo or AOL, they get 1,000 requests for 2,000 accounts per year. I mean, that doesn't really alarm me. I mean, these numbers seem more or less reasonable. There are some terrorists out there, some bad guys. But if the NSA is vacuuming up everything by listening to all the fiber, that is where you can have a tremendous amount of abuses and a challenge for a democratic system of governance.
And is the fiber surveillance you're alluding to, is that where we have this slide with the little smiley face written by someone at the NSA showing the SSL added and removed here on the Google front end server where Brandon Downey, a Google security engineer, had a lengthy and pointed post on this topic? Yesterday or the day
same
before.
Thing. I mean, we've seen most of the more interesting revelations have actually been about the fiber taps, and we've known about them since 2007. The Mark Klein declaration, the former AT&T technician, that filed in an EFF lawsuit saying, "There's a secret room. It's on Folsom Street in San Francisco at the AT&T facility. Mm-hmm. I've been in there, and this is what happens." But we didn't realize how pervasive it was, and how broad it is beyond AT&T. I mean, Google, I think a few years ago when they started encrypting everything between the customer and their servers by default, they believed, maybe naively, maybe it's a question of prioritizing resources, they're working on the customer-to-server encryption as opposed to server-to-server encryption. It's leased fiber. They never really even thought the NSA could do it. But when you're up against an adversary that is so determined and so powerful and has a 10-plus billion budget that's devoted to nothing but finding flaws in your system, you have to be extra careful. Now they're encrypting everything.
Well, it's a depressing thought. Evan, do you have any different kind of slant on this?
No, I can't add to what Declan and Sherwin have said on this. And, you know, I'll just go ahead and be my cynical self and just say, you know, I can't wait till the next round of elections and we get all of the, you know, legislators out of office, get rid of all the incumbents and, you know, start anew. So I'll just be cynical when it comes to that. You know, because Larry Downs last week told us nothing's going to get done in Congress this session with all the stuff that's going on. So I'll just go ahead and sit here and be all, you know. Fox Newsy.
I don't know. We seem to get rid of them and bring them back, and nothing really ever seems to get done in a good way.
And some of the most stubborn people in Congress are in some of the safest districts. I mean, that's sort of the nature of it. You know, people feel sometimes people who are so safe don't feel the need to work with their colleagues or listen to the concerns of people who might not be the majority in their district. So there's something to be said on that.
All right. Well, I need a dose of good news from Washington after that discussion. Let's go ahead and drop in an MCLE passphrase for this portion of the show. We'll go ahead and make that Dark Mail in honor of the Dark Mail Alliance. If you're listening to the show for continuing legal education credit, we drop these phrases in case your regulatory board needs to have some confirmation that you've actually listened. So we drop a couple of phrases in at random during the show, and you can say, hey, I know the secret voids. I listened to the show. So we appreciate if you're listening to the show for that reason or for any reason. And so let's move on to some good news from Washington. Not so good news for public knowledge. I guess you guys are going to miss Gigi Sohn quite a bit, but she's going to do a great job at the FCC, I trust.
Yeah, you know, we're terribly excited that mm-hmm. that she's going to be there. Huh. I mean, it's one of these things where it's always good to get people inside the FCC who can look at it with a critical eye. You know, it's I think a lot of times people will think about the FCC just in terms of this this sort of monolith, uniform regulatory agency, and in truth, it's there's a lot of different moving parts within it, and a lot of people doing a lot of disparate and intricate stuff there. If you go to one of their open meetings, you'll see, you know, for everything on net neutrality or a thing on prison phones, there's also like five different things on how are we allocating these spectrum bands for these satellites to communicate with this and that and the other. And there's a whole lot to be done. And I think, you know, we're definitely going to miss Gigi here, but we think that she can do a lot of good on the inside.
Declan, are you optimistic about the Tom Wheeler FCC and the appointments he's made to date?
Honestly, I haven't followed it closely enough. I am on sabbatical, so I'm not following every nuance as I normally would. I mean, congrats to Gigi for doing this. I mean, she's got to. If there's a Republican elected in a few years, maybe as part of an anti-surveillance backlash, at least she's got a few years in before the FCC turns Republican, or at least possibly. But I don't have a good enough feel of where the FCC is heading or how. I mean, the net neutrality question is going to be an interesting one, but that's going to be settled by the courts. I mean, in my view, which I would differ with public knowledge, the FCC is overreach. I mean, it got slapped down once by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and now they're going to get slapped down again.
Evan, any thoughts on Gigi and the FCC?
No, I mean, it's great to see, you know, where she comes from. You know, it's not what you would necessarily expect from somebody like Wheeler. So that's the encouraging thing. You know, I think of, Lincoln and the team of rivals, at least in as much as having, at least on paper, different ideologies to assemble a unit of government and power there. So that's encouraging to see that the method by which the new FCC chair is going about things. So that's how I see it.
Sherwin, did you guys have any warning that this was coming, or are you kind of scrambling to decide how public knowledge is going to forge ahead without her?
No, we're not scrambling. I think, you know, first of all, Gigi wouldn't have accepted if she thought that it was going to throw the org into complete chaos or even partial chaos. Aside from trying to plan her goodbye party, that was sort of a little bit more last minute than we'd like. But no, yes. Part of the idea of putting together an organization like this is to making sure that you've got a plan for succession. And there had been, if not specific talks on this, you know, there was a plan in place. And so we just had to sort of slide into that. On a slightly faster time frame.
That's great.
You know, and one of the things I just think is funny to see all these news stories talking about how odd it is that that they're getting somebody out of public interest is, as happy as I am for all of this to happen, it's a little bit disappointing to see that that's like a strange thing that you'll have to look at. You can't possibly why would an agency hire someone from public interest when people get hired out of the private sector, out of the companies that these agencies are regulating, as a routine matter. So.
Oh, sure. Sure. When everyone thinks you're weird, you just don't realize it. That's all.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Sherwin. All right. We've got a couple of other random stories that don't really fall into any particular category, but are interesting nonetheless. Declan, you tweeted this story. I don't know if you tweeted the story, but you retweeted the person who noticed that an advice column over at The Guardian had pulled out, some stock photograph from Getty Images of a woman looking stressed and upset, and put it with an article that discussed women who like to have relations with old obese men. And the person on Twitter decided that the stock photo model probably didn't like that headline much, and that this was one of the perils of being a stock photo model. What could possibly go wrong, they said. So, in point of fact, The Guardian laughed at itself a bit and wrote a follow-up article about the model Samantha Ovens and her take on it. And it raises some interesting legal issues in the digital age. Stock photography is such a common way of not just mainstream outlets like The Guardian, but bloggers and others to illustrate their stories. And it's also quite prone to being used without authorization. So although The Guardian clearly had all the proper licensing in place, and Miss Ovens, you know, knows that her image is going to be used in various ways and really doesn't have any restrictions on that. One restriction that could come into play is if someone lifted the image without actually paying Getty Images and then portrayed her in a way that was not acceptable to her or, you know, acceptable to Getty because it's in an uncompensated way. So, Declan, did you point to this clearly strictly because it was a bit of a laugh, or were you looking at some of these broader legal issues?
Oh, more a bit of a laugh. I mean, there are some legal issues. I guess there are legal issues almost everywhere you look. And in a previous life, I was a photographer part time, and so then if you're doing photography with models, you're going to get a model release. And I had a model release I'd have them sign, and it's pretty. It's very photographer friendly. We can pretty much do anything with it as long as they're 18 and up. You don't have to worry about parental consent. And so then you put yourself in this position of being a model, then you don't know where it's going to end up, and you can really never get your rights back. On the other hand, you got paid for what you're doing, and as an adult, you figure that you know what you're getting into. I did not actually see the follow-up Guardian piece. I'm glad to know they have a sense of humor about this. But you probably, when modeling for a relatively low wage or daily rate, you probably don't think you're going to end up on the front page of the Guardian on an article about wanting to have sex with old obese men. And one other point, I mean, sometimes you've seen companies and even news organizations overuse the same stock photos. You might have multiple news organizations try to illustrate a similar article, and the same photo appears, and it's kind of a little embarrassing when that happens.
I mean, do you think Miss Ovens here is certainly concerned about protecting her image? She has modeled for Colgate and various other large companies, British Airways, and doesn't want to be, you know, necessarily associated with having sex with obese old men because it could damage her ability to get hired by some of these large corporate entities in the future. Do you think that she might have some sort of legal ground to stand on?
Well, it's difficult. And, you know, I have actually represented more than one model in the situation where there were two situations like this where their photos were being used. It was more so in, you know, outside of the scope in terms of volume, like being used more often than what they had anticipated. And when I realized, I say, yeah, I represented models. It makes me sound much cooler than what I really am. But and so the trouble that arises in that situation is calculating how it is that you're going, you know, what it is you're going to do about it. You know, how do you quantify any damages you may have suffered, because this is all prospective, and, you know, we're dealing with, you know, $500 a pop here, you know, where, you know, for, you know, for paying a model for a gig, you know, I'm, you know, I don't know if it was $500, but, you know, relatively small amounts like that. And then trying to forecast out what the effect is going to be in the long term on a career. And so if you were to really litigate one of these issues, you'd have to get a bunch of expert testimony in, and, you know, it'd be an extremely difficult and expensive case to put on. And it's all very, very problematic, and you just don't know where it's going to come out. So it's there's, even if a model release is very well written in favor of the model, where the anticipated use of it is clearly spelled out, whether in terms of volume or in subject matter, what have you, and the rights of publicity are constrained in those ways, it's still very difficult to do anything about it if there's a breach of that agreement. So it's the models can be in a difficult position.
This Guardian article is fairly funny. They do get Samantha on record that she doesn't think that her reputation has been damaged by this, which is a good thing. She's happy that she's gained some Twitter followers. as a result. But just at the end, they throw in the fact that just the world of stock photography is so ripe for ridicule and just sort of delighting in the absurdity of it. That there are fan sites devoted to this category of shots of women laughing with salad. There's a whole Tumblr site for that of shots. Women laughing with salad. So there you go. Hopefully their fantasies involve something more green and wholesome than what the Guardian column was all about. Some other just kind of random stories out there this week. You can buy a car with bitcoins, Evan, in Australia. I know you're excited about this.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? You know?
Yes.
You know, I saw this in the rundown for today, and I just put together a quick blog post yesterday, you know, thinking about some of these things. It actually exposes some interesting new uses of Bitcoin, or at least for reasons why, you know, that are different than what we ordinarily think of. You know, Silk Road has gotten a lot of attention lately, hand in hand with the Bitcoin, the issue of the use of Bitcoin. And so we think of one of the big uses of Bitcoin being, you know, it's anonymous. And you know, it could be used to engage in these kind of CD transactions. But what we see here with Tom Carr, the Australian entity Tom Carr, who makes these kind of off-road commercial vehicles, almost like glorified pimped out golf carts, from what I can tell, you know, these kind of more more substantive type of vehicles. I was about ready to swear, so I was having to stop with that. You know, and so you see them now selling these things directly using Bitcoin, and it's not so that the buyer can be anonymous. You know, you got to know where to ship the darn thing, usually overseas, and that therein lies the new use for it. It's to avoid disfavorable exchange rates in currency and international transactions, and to avoid, you know, the merchant processing fees, credit card fees, like that. And so, you know, it looks like we're seeing a new expansion. And granted, I mean, those who watch Bitcoin much more closely than I do have probably seen this for months and can give all kinds of examples and say, Evan, you know, you're late to the game in making these observations here. But at least it's coming into my consciousness that, oh yeah, you know, there are these uses for Bitcoin, especially when it's the market is a little, when it will be a little less volatile in the future, assuming there's wider adoption of this. Plenty of uses other than buying drugs and hiring hitmen on Silk Road. Very legitimate uses, actually, in the marketplace and in the supply chain on this. Interesting stuff.
Maybe there are investment banking entities out there that let you buy Twitter stock with Bitcoin.
Wouldn't that be the darndest thing?
Yes, that would be. Nice double headline for some Silicon Valley publication. Let's see. Let's move on to some entertainment-oriented stories. Stream Nation, they've been around for a while, but it looks like they have not been around long enough to remember things like 321 Studios that got put out of business because they were a tool that enabled people to rip DVDs. Also, the Grokster decision, the DMCA's anti-circumvention provisions in general, because what Stream Nation is up to these days is a service that allows you, once you have ripped your DVDs, to then share that movie with friends, modeled after Amazon's lending library kind of concept. But here the lending is not from some third-party entity like Amazon, but from user to user. Actually, Kindle book lending may work that way too. I'm not quite sure. Yeah, you can lend a Kindle book to another reader for up to 14 days. So that is user to user too. But it's the DVD ripping part that troubles me here about the legal foundation of this Stream Nation business strategy. What do you think about all this, Sherwin?
I actually don't think the ripping is going to be as big of a problem here because Stream Nation themselves, as far as I could tell, wouldn't be doing the ripping. So I think their tack on this is, okay, if you have the file, upload it to the server, and you can access it in the cloud, and then your friends can access it in the cloud. I actually think that their digital lending thing is more what's going to get them in trouble. But on the ripping part, if it's the user doing the ripping and they're the ones doing the circumvention, it's them that should be directly liable. And, you know, just because it's possible that somebody could do that and then upload that to Stream Nation. I mean, there's plenty of video files that aren't going to be DRM'd. So I think that, you know, somebody trying to leverage both 321 Studios and Grokster together and munch them together and use that to hold Stream Nation liable, I'm actually a little bit more skeptical that you can get a secondary, that you're going to get a secondary circumvention issue there. What does worry me, though, is, and I think the case that they should be worried about, is Redigi as a precedent, because as much as, although Amazon will let you lend Kindle books, I'm pretty sure that that's done via a license from the publisher, and the publishers can turn that on and off. Here, it seems like they're relying upon fair use to say that, well, look, if we're going to only allow one person to access it at a time, it's just as if you'd, you know, handed them the DVD and said, bring it back, which in a practical sense is entirely true. But if you believe the district court in Redigi, that's still going to get you in trouble under copyright law.
This seems like another one of those situations, Declan, where, you know, intuitively we all understand that this is the way it should work, but the law is getting in the way of it working in an efficient and intuitive manner, potentially.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you were, I go back to my earlier point, if you were designing a copyright system today from scratch without taking into account legacy legal decisions and statutes that may not have been updated for quite a while, you'd probably allow this. It makes a lot of sense. A cloud-based storage of your movies. I mean, I'm an happy Apple and a happy Google user, and the two don't really talk. I can have videos that I have legal rights to on my computer, but then my Apple TV in my living room won't play them. It's all kind of highly annoying, and so I like this idea quite a bit. Now, the question is whether Hollywood and some of the large content owners are going to be sort of mature enough to let this exist, or whether we're going to see a preemptive litigation as soon as this takes off, if assuming it does take off.
Evan, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, there you have Declan already seen the big picture of, you know, what will make sense in the marketplace. And here I am bringing it back to copyright nuance. You know, I could see being concerned about the ripping, there being an act of copying there that would give rise to liability under Section 106 of the Copyright Act, or, you know, a violation of one of the Section 106 rights. This also seems like a situation where it would be one of those actually relatively rare situations where the distribution right would be at issue here, and that could form the basis of infringement. You know, usually we always by rote memory say that the exclusive right to distribute the work is one of the rights under Section 106, but most of the time the exception swallows up the rule there because of the first sale doctrine. So it is kind of unusual to find where there really is infringement by means of unauthorized distribution of a work. But that does seem like what could be happening here, the user uploading it. And this wouldn't necessarily be the service provider, the platform doing this, but it would be perhaps a Grokster form of inducement here saying, hey, upload your Hollywood blockbuster with a small b, not the company going out of business. You know, movie up to our server and share it in the way that we're providing for you here. And that is thereby creating a violation of that exclusive right to distribute the work. So that's the nuance I would want to point out to this in terms of bringing out, you know, the manner in which there could be some infringement here, one that is perhaps not as obvious as some of the others.
Right. They're clearly going to have to be careful with their marketing and what they tell people about this service. And as Sherwin said, they're going to want to rely on the fact that there's lots of material on there other than ripped movies. So if they're smart, they will do a lot of encouraging of, you know, various kinds of videos that don't involve breaking DVD encryption to get them up there. Sherwin, you pointed this out to me. I think you tweeted it earlier this week. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think, you know, Evan points out that ripping itself might violate the right of the copyright holder to reproduce the work. I'm not mm-hmm. so sure that that's that a court would really find that. I think, you know, we've got the Sony Betamax case, and we've got nobody's actually been willing to challenge CD ripping. Right. So, you know, CDs that don't have DRM, you just rip them to your iPod or you know, whatever your favorite MP3 player is. And nobody's been willing to challenge that in court. And I think the going assumption and the safe assumption now is that that's perfectly legal. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the Reproduction Act is really going to get them in trouble. It's the lending that there's some precedent where people have tried to create through DRM a sort of digital first sale. And even though that to me seems like it really should be the way things work, there's at least one case that says that that courts aren't going to like it that much. One other thing that I will note is that I think the Internet Archive is actually doing a book lending program, sometimes through existing libraries, but also I think just, you know, sometimes just on its own as well, where you will be able to borrow ebooks and borrow ebooks from existing libraries, and they do that also with a sort of a DRM system where somebody with access to an ebook loses that access when they loan it to somebody else, and they get it back. And so far, they've been doing that pretty well. And you know, the Internet Archive being a pretty responsible party for this sort of thing.
Well, it's one to keep an eye on for sure. I know that every now and then I can't find my copy of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And I know that Evan has one, but he lives all the way in Chicago. So I can't really wait for him to ship it out to me. We need to be able to share it in a more streamlined way than that. So we'll have to see how Stream Nation does with this. Tell us about Sample Trolls, Sherwin.
This is, you know, this sort of came up a little earlier when everybody was talking about Robin Thicke getting sued for Blurred Lines. So the estate of Marvin Gaye and this company called Bridgeport Music sued, saying that he was copying Marvin Gaye and Funkadelic songs in it. And I think there's an open question as to whether he actually used samples in the songs, and I don't know if they're arguing that he did. On the other hand, so if you're just copying the general sound of something, that's not going to be an infringement. But there are existing cases where people took tiny samples of existing songs and got sued, and there was one court in, I believe it was the Sixth Circuit Court, that in a case with Bridgeport Music that said, oh, no, it's always infringement if you use a recording of an existing song, no matter how tiny that sample is. And that's been sort of the people have made that the default assumption with sampling. And to me, that can't be true. It's not true for any other sort of copying where you take a tiny amount, a tiny quote of something, and that automatically makes it an infringement. The reason I was talking about sample trolls is that Bridgeport Music is actually a sample troll. Basically, it's one guy, and he bought up the rights to a bunch of Funkadelic music and has just been going around. And if you do a Alexa search, you can see they're the plaintiff in dozens of cases. And it's just based upon whether or not some of these classic songs got sampled and put into a beat. For what it's worth, George Clinton thinks that these sorts of suits are ridiculous. The guy who actually made music, as opposed to somebody who just bought the rights to it.
Yeah, that is an irony of this all. So if it wasn't sampled, if it was just sort of a similar sounding riff, then aren't we in the realm of George Harrison and the Chiffons and My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine? George Harrison didn't do so well there.
I think it can depend upon how much of the taking you have. I mean, when we talk about samples, that can range you know, you can call something a sample when you've taken, you know, a couple of bars of something and plugged it in. And I think, you know, Vanilla Ice didn't do so well with that either.
Right.
On the other hand, some of these samples can be fractions of a second. It can be a note. You know, people have, just as a sort of an exercise, used samples of individual notes from other songs to create an entirely different song. I think you're running into something very different there.
Maybe we just need some folks to sit on the sidewalk and charge $20, and then, you know, everyone will be in good shape. The people who are still in shape to battle litigation, you know, Viacom is just, they keep on a-going in this case with YouTube. YouTube has won twice in the trial court, and Viacom now hopes to win twice on appeal. They are back in the appellate court in the Second Circuit on the question of whether YouTube violated its copyrights in various works, and whether YouTube can avail itself of the safe harbors of the DMCA. So there's really not that much to discuss here. The EFF has gone through the opening brief in detail, and we were talking about the Grokster case a few moments ago, and that is when liability attaches because you're encouraging users to infringe. And that seems to be where Viacom's going with its opening brief, that users are actually being induced to infringe. They're pulling out also evidence of ill-advised internal emails, knowledge that the service could be used to infringe, and the business choice not to let some content owners use YouTube's filtering tools, and saying that that should amount to inducement. How do you think they'll do on that, Sherwin? Do you think they will once again carry the day in the Second Circuit?
I think that YouTube has a pretty good case here. You know, full mm-hmm. disclosure, you know, Public Knowledge has signed on to the EFF brief. So I think, you know, I don't think it's any secret where our opinions are on this. But
right.
I think that, honestly, if you look at the sort of the history of the case, what happened is when the Second Circuit first got this case, you know, they eliminated a bunch of some of the truly wacky arguments that Viacom was bringing up, and then said, okay, and we don't have enough facts to make a full decision on these other things, so we'll send them back down to the district court, and now it's back up again, and Viacom is throwing everything they've got into the remaining arguments. I think that, you know, on the one hand, you know, they're trying to go for inducement because it's a little bit of a way of trying to get around the DMCA safe harbors, which shouldn't work. The safe harbors apply mm-hmm. to both direct and secondary infringement. You know, inducement is a kind of secondary infringement. And they're trying to skip that step by sort of going into some of the details of how inducement works. In terms of the internal emails, the reason it's important that those are internal emails is, you know, one of the ideas with inducement is you have to take some sort of active action to cause somebody to infringe. You have to want them to infringe, and you have to sort of actively encourage them to do that. And, you know, Viacom's saying, well, you've got these emails back and forth between YouTube founders and YouTube executives saying, oh, we've got infringing stuff up here. But if that information doesn't get communicated to anybody who's actually uploading stuff, who's actually infringing the copyrights themselves, well, that doesn't do anything. You can sit there and hope for infringement all you want, but if your service is actually, you know, in its actual operations above board, you're not inducing that infringement.
Declan, can you figure out why Viacom keeps litigating this case?
Well, I'm going to have to side with Sherwin on this one. And in terms of where I'd like to see it go if I'm wearing my columnist hat, and in terms of why Viacom is continuing, I mean, it's odd because they're litigating against the 2005 era YouTube. And as a practical matter, I mean, YouTube is going beyond what copyright law requires. This is the Content ID program, which is a few years old. I mean, if YouTube wanted to screw over copyright holders, they could just discontinue that, or better yet, just discontinue it for Viacom-only content, and then good luck, Viacom, in trying to police what's going on here. I mean, they're doing a favor to copyright holders with this fingerprinting program. But my guess is that it comes down to money. I mean, maybe they can get a multi-hundred-million-dollar judgment, probably not a settlement at this point, from Google. And even if there's a 10% chance of that, it's still worth it because the attorney's fees are less. That's my guess.
All right. Well, let us move on to our tip and resource of the week. We have a couple of tips for you this week because they both seemed like worthwhile things to bear in mind as you're out there making your way through the world. Make sure you don't run afoul of either of these pitfalls. Conan O'Brien's show and also a local radio station ran afoul of an FCC rule that says that you cannot use the emergency broadcast alert system, either sound or visual. In other words, you can't confuse people as to whether the emergency broadcast alert is on or not. On Conan's show, they used it to promote the appearance of Jack Black in an April 2012 episode. And this local radio station, it's a Kentucky television station, WNKY, simulated the emergency alert sound in an ad for a menswear store. So the FCC has taken a hard line in both these instances, and I think would in others, that you just can't do that. So the emergency alert system is not something that you can remix and parody and make creative use of as these entities tried to. The Conan show got slapped with a $25,000 fine, and the TV station in Kentucky got slapped with a $39,000 fine. So just leave that emergency broadcast signal alone, no matter how funny you think it might be. This is something that got tweeted to me in the context of, I think it was Totally Fried who said, I have to tell my colleagues this over and over again, that you're not allowed to, if you are a sysadmin or an IT manager, particularly if you're the IT manager for the principal network engineer for the Department of Telecommunications and Information Services for the city and county of San Francisco, who decided that he was going to, we're back to whether you can be forced to give over your keys, your encryption keys, your passwords. In this particular instance, absolutely yes, because this network engineer, when he was suspended from his job, refused to divulge the passwords to keep the city and county of San Francisco in control of its network. The guy got charged under California's criminal statute, California Penal Code Section 502C5, which makes it a crime to knowingly and without permission disrupt or cause the disruption of computer services, or denying or causing the denial of computer services to an authorized user of a computer system, or computer network. So long story short, the guy got 4 years in prison and a $1.5 million fine, and that has been confirmed on appeal. So rather big slap on the wrist for deciding someone was going to sit on the city and county of San Francisco's network passwords. Declan, did you hear anything about this, being that you are a local there?
Well, it keeps popping up in local news reports and has been for a while. I mean, it's kind of every IT or sysadmin's dream in a way to hold, assuming you have an evil boss, do something like this. And in reality, I think this is government IT at its finest. I have no idea why it would be so centralized that one person could hold it hostage. it's pretty easy if you have physical access to the servers, assuming your system is competently designed, which may not be the case with the city government, to just go in and go to the console and change the passwords that way. So I don't understand how they ever got themselves into this pickle.
Yes, and even worse than that, not only did he have all the passwords, but he had set it up in such a way that if anyone other than he had attempted to enter the system, it would erase all the data stored and make the network more vulnerable to an external attack. And this is just random, by the filing of an unauthorized copyright application. I don't know what that means, but in any event, it sounds like something lifted from a movie. But our tip of the week to our sysadmin friends out there is don't be sitting on those passwords. Make them available to your employer. They are their property. Our resource of the week is from the High Tech Law Journal at the Santa Clara Law School. And they have some guidelines surrounding criminal prosecution of file sharing services. So the mega upload case being the poster child for this. It's a law review article that is aimed at sort of law enforcement folks, prosecutors, saying when, you know, obviously they have the discretion to prosecute people, but when is that really a good idea? And the article here thinks that it would only be a good idea if you're using theories of liability that are already established at the appellate level, so you're not breaking new ground, that you should go after prominent services like Mega Upload, because that would be give you the highest likelihood of deterring future illegal activities, and also that criminal enforcement should be saved for when civil enforcement is likely to be futile. Evan, did you take a look at this, and do you agree with these guidelines?
For the most part, I have a little bit of difficulty getting behind that one recommendation where prosecutors shouldn't try, shouldn't put forth any theory at the trial court level that hasn't been tested on appeal. To me, there's just something that's not quite right about that, or doesn't really comport with how our system works, where theories get, you know, pushed at the trial court level. And if they're, you know, if they comport with everything that we, hold dear in our common law, they'll survive on appeal. It just seems like there's just something not quite right about that, because, you know, the very opposite of what these guidelines are trying to address could come about from that. Let's say, you know, prosecutors do advance a bunch of dumb theories at the trial court level. Don't we want appellate courts knocking those down and saying that that's not how criminal copyright should be enforced? So for those reasons, I'm having a little bit of trouble getting behind that one. But, you know, as far as the rest of it goes, sure. You know, don't go after everyone for criminal copyright liability. Only go after the big ones, you know, e.g. Mega Upload, for that. You know, so the other guidelines are okay. I just take a little bit of issue with that as a general theory, not just doesn't have anything to do with criminal copyright per se.
Yeah, as soon as I read that, I thought immediately of Lori Drew, which wasn't in the copyright context, but, you know, I could see the authors of this article wanting to have criminal prosecutors not breaking new ground in a way that could be dangerous, as happened in Lori Drew's situation, where she was found criminally liable for violating terms of service. So that's what I thought of, is that they just want to rein in that kind of danger. But you're right. Our legal system is for testing new theories for good or ill. Declan, any thoughts on this?
This is maybe not a direct answer to your question, but I was the first person in the world to disclose the existence of nonprofit criminal copyright infringement. This is when President Clinton signed the No Electronic Theft Act into law, and I kept calling his staff until they say, yeah, as I said, actually, yes, he finally signed it. Now stop annoying us. And so I was the first to report it. This is another example of special interest lobbying and turning what would normally be something that could be punished with just as a civil offense, copyright infringement, not for profit. You're not selling this stuff. You might just be, you know, giving someone a copy of Microsoft Word or a DVD, and turning that, assuming it meets the statutory thresholds, into a misdemeanor or federal felony. And it's pretty easy to meet these statutory thresholds. And so this is what Harvey Silverglate would call the criminal defense attorney. It was his recent book out on, was it 6 felonies a day, would call the over-criminalization of normal activities. I mean, maybe these are bad activities, but we don't need to turn them into federal felonies. I don't see this changing anytime soon. I mean, especially now that Gigi left public knowledge.
That's right. All right, well, we'll go ahead and make the Lori Drew problem our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Got both of those in. Declan, weren't you also one of the first people to call Al Gore on having invented the internet?
That was, I mean, this is going back just as far in history. What I recall is that Wolf Blitzer was interviewing Al Gore, and he said, during my service in the United States Congress, I took the initiative in creating the internet. Wolf didn't challenge him. So the next day I wrote an article for Wired that said, well, the internet had actually existed back when Al was, in college. He may have had a role in increasing the funding, but there's a big difference between increasing the funding versus actually being a technologist that created it. And so probably someone would have called attention to Al's exaggeration if I didn't, but I happened to be the first one to poke a little bit of fun at him, and you know what happened from there.
Yes, you get first post credit on that. Tell us too, we're talking about your firsts. Tell us how recent will be a first in the way that we consume and read news.
Well, I don't have a whole lot to announce today. I'm still working on it, but I took a sabbatical from CNET for a few reasons. One is that I'd been there, 11 years, and so it was time for a bit of a break, but also to work on an idea I had, which is personal news. There's so much out there, and it's so difficult to actually find what's relevant to you. If you could have an app that learns what you like over time and then and provides on a minute-by-minute basis a personal news feed, then that could be interesting. I'm really doing it to solve my own problems of finding out what's out there that I need to know about. But then once it's done for me, it can be done for everyone. There are other companies trying this. I mean, and there's some worthy competitors in this space. Flipboard has a magnificent product, but it approaches this in an entirely different way. You can sign up for a beta at recent.io, recent.io. And I'm hoping to have something in the hands of at least a few testers in the next month or so.
Well, it's great that you're working on this, not only because we obviously need better ways to filter through all the noise and actually get to things that are personally interesting and relevant, but also because if anyone is going to pay attention to the security aspects of knowing enough about you to be able to deliver that kind of information in an effective way, I'd want that person to be you, Declan. It's a good thing.
You're very kind. The back end is using Google App Engine, and it's HTTPS encryption whenever the client is the app, the iOS and Android app, is talking to the back end, everything is should be secure. But I'm going to make sure that I'm not the only one looking at the security. I hope your faith is justified.
I'm sure it will be. Evan, it's been another great show. Thanks so much for being able to join us today. I always love getting together with you at the end of the week.
Yes, I've enjoyed it too. Wonderful conversation. So really, really have enjoyed it and looking forward to next week as well. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you very much. Sherwin, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
I know things are definitely hopping in your neck of the woods, so we really appreciate you taking the time and giving us all your thoughts and insights today, other than what we've already discussed today. And of course, following along with you on the public knowledge site, is there anything upcoming that you want to let our listeners and viewers know of?
Ooh, upcoming. You know, it's not upcoming. It's just something that I did notice making its way around the news the other day. But speaking of the Internet Archive, I think they had a fire there recently that did a considerable amount of damage at one of their scanning centers. So wow. I'm sure if people are like what they do and are supporters of them, they should check that out and see if you can give them a hand.
Yeah, definitely. That there's some sort of sad irony to the fact that the Internet Archive could be just as vulnerable to a fire as any other kind of entity. But of course, there are records and things that can be destroyed even when they're stored digitally. So
that's why you have distributed backups, and which
yes,
they do.
Definitely. All right. Well, thanks for letting us know about that. Declan, it's been so much fun having you on the show. Really, really appreciate your taking the time, and wish you all the luck in the world with what you're working on.
You're very kind. Thank you for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. Good luck in this.
All right. Folks, if you have been joining us live, that means you've been listening at 11 o'clock a.m., 1800 UTC. Actually, we just changed the clocks here in the Pacific time zone. That means you're going to be listening to us for the next several months at 1900 UTC when we record the show live. So please do try and join us live when you can. We have IRC that you can jump into and interact with us during the show. We love that. Of course, we also love it when you find the time in your day at any time to tune in to TWIL. You can do that by going to twit.tv/TWIL. You can go to our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're on iTunes. We're on Roku. Because we're on YouTube, I think it's pretty straightforward to get us to play on a lot of TVs out there without having to even have a separate set-top box. So we're thrilled that you can join us however you decide to tune in. And between the shows, we'd love to hear from you too. Head on over to our Facebook or Google Plus page. Let us know what's on your mind and what feedback you have for us. We develop a lot of the ideas for the show from the things that people tweet to us and put on Facebook and Google Plus. So we really appreciate your input there. Also, what else, Evan? What am I forgetting to tell people?
I think that's it. Yeah.
Is that it? Oh, I know what to tell you. You know, we talked about a whole lot of stuff today. We talk about a whole lot of stuff every week. And we know that sometimes you might want to go back and delve deeper into some of the topics. So we do keep a list of everything that we've discussed on the show. I do that in Delicious because it's easy and convenient for me. So if you head on over to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/235 for this episode, you'll find links to everything we discussed. And actually links to things that we may have been planning to discuss that we didn't get around to. So if you're looking for some interesting reading, that's where you should head on over to. So we'll hope that keeps you busy for the next week or so, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.